This is our first event that we are having. This is our first event that we're having in the home of Melanie and Isaac Piha. They have been friends of ours, and we've been, we've been over the years, we've been involved with them, and it's a real pleasure to be in their home tonight, and big yasher koach for setting things up so beautifully. We hope that our presence here tonight will be a source of great blessing for you both and for your entire family. Be'ezras Hashem. I would like to acknowledge the presence of two very dear friends of Jep, who are here with us this evening, Sydney and Firma Pfeiffer. They have dedicated, would you mind taking a bow for a moment? They have dedicated an annual lecture, including tonight's lecture, in memory of their parents. Their parents were individuals who built Torah homes decades ago when it was not nearly as popular to build a Torah home as it is today. And knowing Sydney and Frum as well as I do, and this and some of their siblings, we can bear witness to the fact that the Mesiras Nefesh, the self-sacrifice of their parents, really paid off. And we hope and we pray that the words of Torah that we hear tonight will serve to elevate their departed neshamos in Gan Eden. It is my great pleasure tonight to introduce a very dear personal friend, Rabbi Label Lamb. Rabbi Lamb has, we've had Rabbi Lamb on a number of occasions, and whenever he comes, he really blows everybody away. We'd like to also acknowledge the presence of Rabbi Lamb's production manager, his mother, who brought him into the world. I don't know if is that the first time you were ever introduced as a production manager? Okay, just checking. Actually, Rabbi Label Lamb grew up in a town adjacent to where we are right now. He grew up in Eastchester. And, you might wonder which yeshiva did Rabbi Lamb attend in Eastchester. Well, he did attend the Eastchester Public School, where he was a halfback on the Eastchester football team. He's gone along, he's really tackled many difficult situations in life and been a tremendous source of inspiration. I spoke with a Rabbi Osher Israel, who I'm very close to, who's very involved in the area of Jewish outreach. And he told me this 2 days ago. He said an email just went out to a whole wide array of outreach organizations in which the following information was included. Make sure you try to schedule Rabbi Label Lamb, because he's phenomenal. And by the end of the evening, I believe you'll understand fully what's behind this email. Rabbi Lamb, he does lecture for many, many different organizations. He's been on the staff of Awesome Ech in Muncie, which is just a spectacular learning organization. And at the present time, Rabbi Lamb has decided to channel his energy and his drive, and he's a specialist in terms of insight into human beings. He's a very warm, personable individual, and actually he's become involved, in addition to his Torah lectures, he's also recently become involved as a life coach and as a hypnotherapist. Perhaps he's going to hypnotize us all tonight, and we'll be here for 6 hours, and we'll all of a sudden we'll walk outside, and we're not going to have to leave. But in any event, without any further ado, it's my great pleasure and our collective honor to have Rabbi Lamb. Is really a special Talmud Chacham, a very dear friend. Please, Rabbi Lamb, bring your shovel. Please come on up.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Zayshik. You'll just close your eyes now. Okay. I was a baseball pitcher, by the way, at local East Chester High School. I was captain of the high school football team. I was captain of the high school basketball team. I was captain of the high school baseball team. And I would like to invite myself back to tell my personal story sometime. That was something I haven't done here in Westchester County. So I tell people I'm from East Chester in Westchester, and they understand why I grew up confused. Okay. All right. So tonight's topic is already an iconic equation that everybody has in their mind, you know, just like you see a picture of an apple with a bite out of it, right? So we understand what we're talking about. We see a picture of the face of Einstein. You also see this equation, E equals MC squared. I don't know how many people know what it's all about. I didn't make it up, by the way. It's not my idea. But there is a premise that the Talmud says that Malka da'ara kamalka d'rkiya, that the kingship on earth is like the kingship on heaven. This is really the genesis of this idea. If something is true on the earth, right, if there's honor that's given to a king down here, so there's honor that's given to a king above. The earth below is a reflection of things that are happening in the earth, in the heavens above. So therefore, if there's a truism, if there's a truth to the premise that Einstein had promulgated this idea of E equals MC squared, right? So it must have some kind of bearing, some kind of spiritual impact also. It must be emanating from a higher place as well. And that's really, I started thinking about things in that terms, and this is really a handle in order to hold on to an idea of how to invest and how to remain invested in relationships. Because you know, we only have a certain amount of energy, a certain amount of life force, and we want to get the most output. We want to get the most out of it. So the concept of E equals MC squared, maybe we'll just take a moment to explain. Again, I might be swerving out of my territory and into the world of mathematics and physics. And maybe there are some physicists here who can clarify some points. But the basic premise is, it's not so difficult, that E in Einstein's equation equals is energy. E is energy. This is a conservation of energy and matter. There's a certain amount of energy, and E equals, and M is mass, right? And C squared is the constant of the universe squared, right? The constant of the universe is the speed of light. If we want to know, if we want to measure an object and weigh an object and find out from the density of that object how much energy it can possibly potentially yield, so we take the speed of light and multiply it by the mass. And then we know how much energy. The same thing, how much energy has been invested in it is also MC squared. So, you know, the equation, like any equation, it washes back and forth in both directions. So when we're talking about relationships, I have spoke to you know, young singles and queens, whatever, and I said, oh, we're going to talk about E equals MC squared. I said, you know, what do you think E equals MC squared, you know, means to you? What does it mean to the average, you know, puppy love, you know, personality? And equals could equal something like, let's take for example, how about excitement, right? Excitement equals muscles times credit card. You know, how about that? You know, yeah. I mean, those are so many answers, you know. Or how about entertainment? You know, equals E is entertainment equals money times cute car. So, you know, so when we think about what might enter people's imaginations, what would be the E equals MC squared? Maybe if we were the Jersey kids or whatever it is, you know, so that would be our definition of E equals MC squared, a formula for relationships. But I think, you know, we have enough seasoned individuals over here, we can appreciate that maybe we can plug in some other values as well to get the real picture. And therefore, we'll say over here that E, right, which we can also say so close to the word energy, but maybe we'll plug in the word enthusiasm. E equals enthusiasm. Actually, the word enthusiasm, the core of the word enthusiasm has to do with theos, has to do with God infusion. That's really what the word enthusiasm means. Or the basic term that we have for the Almighty here in this world is Elohim, right? So it's really sort of a God. A godly energy, an enthusiastic enthusiasm, a God-infused energy to have that type of Holy Spirit, E equals, right? And now we'll jump to the other side of the equation, right? That's the energy that when a couple gets married, you know, there's all that energy which is present, equals, how do we invest it? And now we come to the other side, and M, I'll say, equals, not so far away from Einstein's proposition, In Hebrew, there's a Hebrew word that's called ma'asim, right? So in English, we said the word is mass, right? Which is the amount of stuff that there is. And in this equation that I would like to employ over here, that we use the term ma'asim. Ma'asim. Ma'asim means, anybody? Deeds. Doing stuff. Action. Doing actions. Actions, you know, we all understand, speak louder than words. As a matter of fact, words are only backed up, you know, by actions. You know, if somebody says, you know, I love you, you know, but they don't take out the garbage, you know, so it's like writing a check and there's no money in the bank, right? So the deeds make the words more real. You know, after, you know, helping somebody or doing something or taking care of their perceived needs, and then saying, you know, I love you, so that's a check that has money in the bank. I think there's an old show too, and I'll probably get someone here who will help me out. I know where I'm going to get my help from. It's either Guys and Dolls or it's My Fair Lady. Don't talk of love, show me. I think it's My Fair Lady, right? Right? The ring is not on the finger, you know, yet, and the engagement is going on and on and on. You know, I love you, I love you, I love you. Don't talk of love, you know, show me, you know, do something. So deeds are very, very important, and it's one of the most powerful currencies in any relationship. And I'd like to explain for just a few reasons why deeds are so powerful, why they're so potent. Number one, as we mentioned already, that deeds, the actions themselves, back up the words, and they make the words more real and more palpable, and they give currency, they give the backing for the deeds, for the words. So when somebody says, I love you, or I care about you, or you're special to me, it means something when it's backed up by action. The second thing is that it changes the doer himself. Deeds change the person who's doing the action. You know, the Talmud says, that lo hamedrash ha'ikar el ha'maisa, the main thing is not the discussion, you know, but the action. And the actions, hakol lefi, and that says another place in the fourth parak of Perek Yavos, hakol lefi rov ha'maisa, everything is according to the majority of deeds. When a person does certain types of deeds, they become transformational. They transform us from one type of person into another type of person. For example, the Nesil Shasharim, the classic Musar ethical book, says that tenuas hachitzonius moreres hasapanimius, that the outward actions wake up the internality of the person. They transforms the insides of the person. I remember we were giving a class in Queens someplace. At the end of the class, a Talmud class, this fella kicks back from the table, big tall fella, Big J, I remember, you know? And he, you know, folds one leg over the other, and he says, Rabbi, you know, in front of the whole group, he says, I hate to go to davening in the morning. That's what he says. You know, some of the fellows in the class were so aghast. They were so, you know, like, that's the way to talk about davening. You know, they wanted to take the candy that was on the table, the nuts, and to throw it at him. You know, there was a few that got, you know, agitated by that, you know, strong language. And, you know, and then they looked to me like, you know, like, you know, they said, how can you talk like that, Jay? You know, and then they talked to me like, Rabbi, tell him off. And I said, Jay, I also hate to go to davening in the morning. You know, I do. It's not easy. You know, when you're sleeping and you're under the, you know, the warm covers and it's cold outside, who wants to get up and go to davening in the morning? I agree with you. I think it was Napoleon that said, when I'm awake, he says, I'm Napoleon. But when I'm asleep, I'm a horse. You know, that's it. You know, so when you sleep, so who wants to get up out of their warm and has a desire at 6, 7 o'clock in the morning to put little black boxes on their arm, right? To you know, I want to stay in bed also, like anybody else. I said, so I agree with you. Matter of fact, a few years ago, I got alerted by a doctor friend of mine who was I had a paronychia, had like a little swelling on my finger. And I told him, you know, the doctor, he's a hand doctor, hand surgeon, he's a close friend of mine. And I said, you know, maybe, you know, you can help me with this because I'm afraid, you know, I was told it might turn into cellulitis. There might be a problem with this. It's starting to swell for a couple of days. Ooh, he says, you're right, that's serious. He says, come to my office, step up on the scale. I said, no, it's my finger over here. He said, no, step up on the scale. I said, no, it's my finger. He says, step up on the scale. Okay, so I step up on the scale, and they start moving over those little, you know, gray bars over there. Like, oh my gosh, I saw numbers I hadn't seen for a while. That was 65 pounds ago, by the way, you know? And I said, oh my gosh, I hadn't been on a scale in such a long time. You know, and he told me, he says, you know, I eat everything I want. He says, but I run 7 miles a day. I said, okay. So I went out and got sneakers, okay, and I started exercising. I told you he used to be an athlete. So he told me, I'll help you. He started walking around the block, and it led to some running. I ended up running 3 miles a day, but in the beginning, it was like lifting heavy weight just to go around the block. And he would hold my hand, and sometimes he would run circles around me as we were going around the block. People would stop their car and say, Rabbi Lim, you need a ride? You okay? I said, I'm okay, I'm okay. And he told me, he says, Label, he says, this should be easy for you. He says, you used to be an athlete. He says, and muscles have memories. I told him, I think mine have Alzheimer's. You know, it's not going. I was waiting for the time it's going to get easy, and the truth is, it never got easy. Exercise never got easy for me. And I told this fellow Jay, who's sitting at the end of that long table in the Talmud class, I told him, Jay, I said, I also hate to go to the davening in the morning. I said, but you want to know something? I like the way it feels when it's over. You know, I like the feeling, you know, when you've done it and you've accomplished it. Because then, you know, when I was asleep, I didn't feel like doing it. But now that I did it, I feel like a different person. I'm glad that I did it. You know, than if I would have slept in. And therefore, when a person does something, actually, one of the oft quoted reasons that the Sefer Chinuch says that why, you know, when he's giving sort of reasons or flavors for mitzvahs, he says, "Adam nifal achar pu'ulasav." A person is affected by the actions that they do. A person is affected by the actions that they do. Actions shape our personality. As a matter of fact, the famous Chofetz Chaim, I'm sure most people have heard of the Chofetz Chaim, he was asked by a student of his that was going out into the workaday world that he has an opportunity to enter into two positions, one of two spots he's going to be at the bank, a certain Polish bank. One, he's going to be at the window where he'll be receiving money. The other side, he's going to be at the place where he's cashing checks and he's giving out money. So he asked the Chofetz Chaim, okay, Rebbe, sometimes people ask the Rebbe's for all kinds of things. Seems like, you know, it's inane or an innocuous type of question. Which position shall I accept? Equal pay. So the Rebbe, the Chofetz Chaim, had a very, very strong opinion about the matter. And what do you think? What do you think his opinion was? At the place where the person is cashing checks and giving out the money, or the place where the person is collecting the money and putting it into the drawer and putting it into the savings account? Which one do you think?
Giving out
the money. He said, yeah, because you're going to give out the money, and over the course of the next 25, 30 years that you're going to be doing this, you're going to be exercising a muscle that's called giving. You're going to become a giver. You're going to become a no-saying. And through the exercise of giving, it's going to affect your personality, and it's going to make you into more of a giver. There's a muscle over there that's called giving, and it's going to make you into someone who's able to hand out and able to do things for other people. Masha Enkein, however, on the flip side, if you're going to be in the place where you're accepting the money, you're the toll collector, even though, theoretically, right, he's putting the money into the bank for people, right? He's handing them a pink slip, you know, don't worry, we're going to writing it into your passbook, and it stays in the bank. So you just put another $300, you're increasing your savings account. So theoretically, the person is doing acts of kindness for people, but the Alter from Kelm, Reb Simcha Zissel, the Alter from Kelm says that we're not so much affected by, psychologically, by what we actually do, I'm sorry, excuse me, by what we are theoretically doing, but what we actually do. That's why someone, he says, that the Alter from Kelm says that when somebody, a doctor, okay, maybe there's a doctor or two here, but you know, he says a doctor should do extra acts of kindness at the end of the day. He says, why not? Okay, my friend the doctor, I went to visit, you know, and I learned with him in his office. So, you know, he runs out like a springbok into the middle of the night to go help people. He's a surgeon. People cut themselves all over the place. You know, he's seen the top of every little kid's head in our community and all over Rockland County, you know. And he and his father, both of them, they're wonderful, wonderful, wonderful people with warm, expansive hearts. And they'll do anything to help anybody. But they should do a little extra kindliness at the end of the day. Why is that? Because I've sat in his office, although theoretically they're helping people. And we've all had the experience, we've gone to the doctor, and theoretically the doctor is there to help you. But his experience is the experience of affliction, right? It's the Spanish Inquisition. There we are. I had a bursitis in my knee, a little swelling. It was keeping me from exercising. And I went to see the doctor. He says, where does it hurt? Over here. Oh, how about over here? Oh, I think that... What if I hold it? You got it. I told you it hurts. Okay. He says, okay, we're just going to put a little shot of cortisone into it. He takes out a big nail, he sticks it right into the front of me, and he goes, see Margie on the way out, please. He helped me. Now for the next couple of weeks, my knee recovered, I was able to do exercise, I never looked back. I said, he helped me. But the experience is a very, very cruel and callous experience. Therefore, the person who's sitting at the window, who's taking at that seat over there, so they're going to have the experience of taking. So therefore, theoretically, the premise is a person, you can take a hard criminal, and you turn them into a candy striper. They're the people that are, wheeling out at the hospital the ladies with the balloons and the blankets and the baby and putting them in the car seat, saying bye-bye, and feel good. And all the, they're doing, all the nice, soft, delicate, and delivering the chocolates and the candies and everything. You make them into a candy striper, and that person will become partially cured because the deeds that they're doing will affect who they are. It'll change the nature of their personality. And the flip side is, you could take a nice Beis Yaakov girl, you could take a nice, sweet yeshiva girl, and you turn her into a prison guard, or one of those people who gives a meter maid for the DOT, and they're going to become cruel, hard-hearted people. I had a book on public speaking. My wife and I we used to flip through it and read and do some of the exercises. It says, come up with a, don't say cliche things. Say, like if say cold, don't say cold as a cucumber. People don't think about it. It just goes through the mind like empty calories. Rather come up with an original phrase, cold as. Somebody says, cold as a brass doorknob. Oh, very good. Okay. And I said, cold as the heart of a meter maid. I'm right here. It's okay. I'm here. Thank you. Too late. Too late. There's a certain swagger, like, thank you, $85, oh my God. So if a person is giving out tickets and afflicting people, it's going to affect them. It's going to make them into a different kind of a person. That's what happens. So the type of deeds that we do and it can affect, and the type of actions that we do affect who we are. I remember when my wife and I, we had our first little bubble, our first little baby, Baruch Hashem, so many years ago. My wife was working in an office, and there was a seasoned, a veteran, a woman who had married off the children in her house already. And, she saw my wife, came into work all out of breath, like she just dropped the baby by the babysitter, and she could, already feel the tension. And she said, darling, it was like her first days back to work after a few weeks of convalescing and taking care of her baby. And she says, darling, I want to tell you something. My wife tells me, this is what she says, Esther, this is what she says. She goes, when you have one child, she says, it's very hard. I know. When you have two, it's even harder. My wife is getting old, She says, when you have three, she says, it gets easy. When you hit seven, then you're really flying. That's it. Now you can't tell, she goes, what this lady said to me? Like, what does that mean? Sit down with a tea, honey, yes dear, okay, fine, let's figure out what it means. What does it mean? I said, when you have one, so you're sitting there with a kid, what do I do? I want to be free. I want to go to the mall. I want to go shopping, but I got this kid. Maybe I'll give the kid to Bubby. I'll send the kid, to the neighbor. We'll do a round robin. I'll watch somebody else's kid for a couple of hours, and I'll go, and that'll give me, now I'm out there free and footloose and fancy free. I don't have anything to worry about. In a few hours, I got to be home because I got the baby. The baby's crying. I left in a formula, left some milk, some expressed milk. I'm good. Beautiful. Right? Now, person has two. Maybe I'll strap one. I'll leave one over here. I'll take a carriage. I'll figure it out. We'll juggle. But it now becomes harder. It becomes much more complicated. You have three. It becomes easy because nobody has a bubby or a friend that's that friendly that's going to say, I'll take care of him. That's it. Now you say, I'm here. This is my job. And now I'm invested into this place over here. And then when you hit seven, then you really fly. So what does that mean? That means she's saying after a while, once a person starts realizing that they're not living for themselves, they're doing things for other people, then all of a sudden that muscle becomes so exercised, the person gets, tremendous strength in this area. Sari Imenu, our great mother, one of the things that she was willing to give up her wonderful holy husband Abraham and share him with Hagar, who gave birth to Ishmael, the birth of the Arab world. And the birth of the blues for us nowadays, and what was her intention? What was her kavana? Why did she do it? She says, "Ulai eboneh, perhaps I'm going to become built up." What do you mean she's going to be built up? I'll become a surrogate mother. I'll take care of a child. I have all this wisdom. I have all this. I'm a principal of a school, but I don't have any students. I don't have anybody that I'm obligated to take care of. I need somebody who's reliant to me, someone who I can teach. I need students. I need a child to take care of. And through having a child, I'm going to become built up. I remember my wife and I took a beautiful trip with a family. We had, I think, three or four children with us at the time, going up to Boston, one of our many trips to Boston. It's a 3.5, it's a 4 hour ride, four hours plus from Muncie. And as we're driving up, I decided, I'm just going to observe and see what's going on. I'm driving the car. Meanwhile, my wife, I think for the whole 4.5 hours, she was like a perpetual motion machine. There wasn't a half a second when she wasn't putting peanut butter on a cracker and then putting butter on a piece of bread and handing it back, wiping somebody's face, changing a diaper, this and that, you know, fixing the changing the game, doing something else, you know, calming somebody down from crying, wiping a nose, you know, constantly making something for me, filling up another cup of this, you know, putting that away, constant. I'm meeting the gorilla there. I'm just driving the car and, you know, and observing what's going on, but she was constantly in motion. Once the person gets that they're doing things for someone and they're doing things for people all the time, it's a big exercise of a certain spiritual muscle that's called giving. And there was one Rebbetzin that my wife and I know very, very well. And the first honeymoon apartment that my wife and I, that we were first married in just a few months. And I don't know how many people remember Hurricane Gloria. Who remembers Hurricane Gloria? Okay, Hurricane Gloria. 83, I think it was. It was 84. I was just married. It was 25 plus years ago. So, okay, so we have an idea of when it was. So, Hurricane Gloria, we had this cute little honeymoon apartment. I know my wife thought it was cute. I couldn't stand up straight in the living room. You know, it was so beautiful. You know, I don't know what you. In the Talmud, that's a punishment called the kippah. They had this place where the person couldn't stand up straight. She just thought it was cute. Very humbling. I had to walk into the room like this. Okay, great. And then Hurricane Gloria, everybody put up their sukkahs. It was Erev sukkahs. Hurricane Gloria came and knocked down everybody's sukkah and left us with about 19 inches of water in the living room. So between the low ceiling and the water level, I needed a gondola to get to my clothing in the back of the room. So we ended up out of our apartment. We were going from pillar to post, and we heard that this Rebbetzin that we're very close with, that she had broken an ankle and sprained an ankle when she was coming up from the basement, one of those, you know, those old, like, Wizard of Oz basements, you know. She was so excited when she heard that a guest that was away for a year was returning, had just driven up to the driveway. Abraham's here. And she just came running out of the basement, and she was, you know, clumsily fell, and she broke an ankle and sprained an ankle. Now, this woman has 13 children, right? And of the last five, two sets of twins, you know, so all within a 3.5, 4 year range over there. I mean, so it's like, you know, up to the eyeballs in diapers, you know, and she's got a broken ankle and sprained ankle. My wife and I said, let's go visit Rebbetzin S. Okay, let's go see what's doing with her. We'll get out of our own misery by visiting somebody else. We went to see her. She was riddling us with questions. And what's going to be? And what did the landlord say? And you know, can it be remedied? And are you looking for a new place? And where are you in the meantime? And what do you have for lunch? You don't have a kitchen. You don't have a stove. No. She goes, oh, you didn't eat lunch. Okay, please come. You know. And I remember her wheeling, you know, herself. She was sitting in a wheelchair. And suddenly we're sitting in the kitchen at the kitchen table. And my wife and I have, in an instant, we have two bowls of hot soup with folded napkins and a fan of crackers in front of us. And before we knew what happened, I looked at my wife and I said, did a lady in a wheelchair just serve us two bowls of hot soup over here? You know, like, she is so beyond. She used to lead midnight missions to go, and there's a bride and groom getting married, to fill up their closets and to fill up their cabinets with food and towels and linen and these type of things. And, you know, and her husband says, I can't keep up with her. So much for everybody. So much that, you know, the muscle is constantly, she's just off the charts. So when you hit seven, you know, a person exercises this muscle, it becomes so transformational that the person not just doing an act of kindliness, they become, as the Talmud says, there's such a notion as an ish chesed, a person of kindliness. That becomes their signature of who they are, that they do and they live, and they only take for themselves enough that they can restore their energy, sharpen the saw, so they can go out and do more and give out to other people. So that's one of the great powers, transformational powers, of this concept of giving. It changes the person who's doing the action and who does acts of kindliness repetitively for somebody else. Another thing that it does is it turns a person into a godly person, because Reb Dessler points out, Rabbi Eliyahu Eliezer Dessler says, that the godly soul is the part that wants to give. The godly soul is there's two parts of a person. We have like a rider and a horse. We have a physical earthy part of us, which is no different than any squirrel or gorilla or horse or whatever. And we've got another part, which is, as it says early on in the Torah, that Yipach Ba'avav Nishmat Chaim, that the Almighty breathed the breath of life into man. And then we have we have this tug of war with inside, two polar opposites. And he says at one point, he says, either the godly soul is dominating and activated, or the physical part is dominating. He says at point, the person is either then a giver or a taker at any one moment. And he says that the physical part is always interested in taking. You know, the squirrels are only collecting nuts for themselves, and, you know, they have an instinct even to protect their children. Grandchildren, they don't have an instinct for. It's an interesting thing. One of my colleagues was at a bris in Yerushalayim, and he stood up and he said about the new grandfather. It was his first time being a grandfather. He says, I want to congratulate this rabbi over here, my colleague, who now became a human being. I was a human being. What do you mean, human being? You know, he's a big rabbi and he's a knowledgeable fellow and he has many students. He has wonderful children. What do you, now he's a human being? He says, yes, because he came to the bris of his grandchild. And since we find in the animal kingdom that there is such a thing, that an animal has a sense of instinct to protect the mother bear, to protect her cubs, and a lion for her, and all across the animal world. But we never find that there's any fealty in any place in the animal kingdom that one animal has for a grandchild, or a grandchild has any feeling and emotion and a sense of pride about a grandparent. No such thing in the animal kingdom, because they're not spiritual, and therefore they can't see, like, I come from this great family lineage, I come from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I'm doing something for history, for the future. They don't build hospitals for other people, they don't dedicate lectures, you know, for anybody else, they don't do anything for departed parents. It's all what's happening, you know, imploded into the moment, into the now. But the godly soul can see and merge into other people's worlds, and can see things for the future, and see things from the past, and do things that are for other people. And that's what the muscle that's being exercised, it's really called, he says, the nefesh elokus, the godly soul. And another way that maisim transform the person, and we touched on it just a moment before, I think one of the things that we do in our house on Friday nights, okay, I have my daughters over here, they can testify, and they can also shrink in the embarrassment that I'm going to mention this point over here. But one of the things that we do every Friday night, right, even if it's snowing, okay, and no matter how many guests we have around the table, and the first couple of times, I'm only sorry we didn't start it 20 some odd years ago. There's only a custom from about 5 years now, or maybe 5 or 6 years. And the first couple of times we did, I got the eyes rolling in the back of my head, like, Abba, you know, like we're not in school, OMG, you know, like whatever it is, you know. Do we have to? And people are like slinking away from the table. But now, you know, can I go first? Is it my turn? And in the middle of the week, we ask a question, everyone goes around the table and say, what did you do that made you feel accomplished this week? It's an unbelievable thing. Yeah, one girl says, she said, I got an 85 on a math test. So someone else says, that's not a good grade. You know, so the girl defends herself and she says, I studied very hard. I'm not very good at math, and I thought I was going to fail. So for me, 85 is a good grade. You know, so we have a little song that goes along with it. We give it like a little highlight, little applause. We had a couple of Bachram from Or Sameach, a couple of guys from Or Sameach. One guy says, he says, I had a nice conversation with my mother this week, an older fellow from Or Sameach. That's an accomplishment, you know. That's his battleground. That's where he's struggling, you know. And sometimes just to have a nice conversation with somebody that you happen to struggle with and you have tension with, hey, that's a big accomplishment. The fellow sitting next to him on the same Shabbos says, I finished the whole book of Tehillim, the whole book of Psalms, each and every day this week. Whoa, 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 whoa. You know, look what he did over there. That's an amazing accomplishment. The fella next to him says, I got up for Shacharis. I got up for the morning prayers 3 times. So for him, he's battling the covers. He's battling the pillow, you know. And it's not so easy. But you know something? That's his battleground. And we found by analyzing these all the statements that are being said that can usually be boiled down to a few different areas. If the person did something that was hard for them to do, or they did something that was for somebody else, right? So, and it could be that it was the thing that they liked least to do at the time that they were doing it, but when it was over, they felt good. As it was an old Rebbe, an old Hasidic Rebbe, that he and his son were breaking into the ice. Okay, we'll put ourselves into tis the season over here. He was breaking into the ice to go into a river to tumble themselves, to mikvahize themselves, to gain a little ritual purity by going into a cold. And it was not even required according to Torah law, but just to gain that extra measure of purity. You know, Hasidim, I also go to the mikvah every day, but not into a cold, freezing, hard enough to get into a cold swimming pool or the mikvah ari. If anybody ever went to the mikvah ari in Sfat, but we're talking about breaking into ice and going into, so the sun goes in first, after breaking his little hole, and he lowers himself into the water. Ouch! Ooh, ah, he comes out with a beard filled with icicles, and when he steps out of the water, and his father says, this is the teachable moment. He says, my son, I want you to always know, he says, that when it comes to doing mitzvahs, he says, mitzvahs start out ouch, 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 but they end up ooh, ah. And when it comes to doing averas, violations, sins, he says they always start out ruah, but they end up ouch, ouch, ouch in the end. You know, just the other way around. So the accomplishment of doing sometimes in doing things that we're not, that are sometimes not easy and stretch us out of our comfort zone, or they're doing things for somebody else, makes us into people that we have this great feeling at the end of the day, at the end of the week, at the end of the life, that we feel that we've accomplished something, and it has a transformational effect on ourselves. But it does one other thing, and we'll spend one other moment on the power of maisim, and that is when somebody does for somebody else. I think it was Rav Volbe writes in his Kuntres HaChassanim, he writes in a little booklet, this famous Rav Volbe, who passed away a few years ago, one of the great ethicists of our generation, and he writes a book for new brides and grooms. He says, what do you want to base your marriage on? And of course, the universal answer he got was love and understanding. And he goes, fools. What? What did we say wrong, Rabbi? You know, it's always like that, you know? He says, You want to love, that's the goal, and you want to understand. But right now, you're just getting to know you, getting to know all about you. You don't love and you don't understand. He says you will love and you will understand, you know, as time goes on, as you give. So Rabbi Dessler says it in an amazing principle, and that is, he says, we don't always necessarily give to the ones we love, right? He says, although there is an instinct and a desire to want to give to the ones we love, he says, but we love the ones to whom we give. Whoever it is that we give to, we end up loving more. He tells a story, it was actually a true story, he includes it in one of his books, that happened to him, that he became separated from his wife during the war, and he took care of a child, and during his formative years, he took care of that child. After the war, the mother had missed out on some formative relationship with that child, and she just didn't have the same feeling, the same attachment to the child, because the father, he was with his son, and he took care of him, and that son, he had a greater heart for, because he invested in him. Anything that we give to, and anything that we invest in, we love that person more, the one to whom we give. Sometimes if the person is not getting along completely with somebody, it's good to do something for them and to give them. And it cures some of the, you know, ill feelings that we might have. Because anything we're going to give and anything we're going to invest in, it's going to make us feel different about that. Talmud says that there's three things that a person finds more dear to him than they are dear to anybody else in the world. And one of them is the person's house, his own house. Okay? What's a big deal? A house. You know, it's my house. So sometimes, you know, I've gone to talk in we're in Westchester County, but, you know, Greenwich, Connecticut, and places where, you know, like the houses that could swallow up three or four houses over here, and our house 10 times over, Saddle River, New Jersey, I go to also, like, whoa, you know, look at those houses over there. And they're impressive pieces of real estate. But I come home, it's my house, you know. That's my house. Yeah. Why my house? Why do I like my house better than I like? Because it's not just a house, not a piece of real estate. It's my home, right? Because I invested in there. That's where I've been putting one third of my salary, or even more, for the last 22 years plus. Right? That's my house. And as a matter of fact, I remember one Sunday, after the winter and the spring, so, you know, the concrete steps in front, so there's a little place where, you know, the water seeps in, and then in the wintertime it freezes and expands, and the steps are starting to crack. You see a little opening, so the steps are starting to crumble. Wife said, did you notice that the steps are starting to crumble? I said, yeah, that's, you know, wow, that's not good. And she said, you know, we should do something about it. I said, yeah. I said, you should call a man. And she says, I just did. I said, oh, good. She goes, I called you. I'm not a mason, you know. She goes, yeah. She goes, you just have to put some concrete. And she says, well, where am I going to get concrete? She goes, well, I already went to Home Depot. It's in the back of the car. The guy carried it in the back of the car. Well, what am I going to do with it? She said, he gave me the instructions. It's written on the thing over there. All you have to do is put it in the water, add water, and, you know, like, you ever play? I said, okay, you know, I know what I'm doing this Sunday, you know. So, you know, so out there, you know, we got a whole bucket and we poured some in and we mixed it in and we had the water and the spritz, you know, and I got into it. It was very good. I started to pack it in, you know, instead of just filling in the cracks, it ended up making like this big, like a boil hanging on the outside over there, you know. And when it dried, I even painted it white. And there's still some left over. I said, you know, some cracks in the driveway. This stuff is good for the driveway, too, you know. I said, good. So we started, and I said, and you know something? I think I have a hole in my tooth, too, you know. Maybe we'll do some dentistry with it. This stuff is amazing, you know. I spent the whole Sunday out there packing. We had the gloves on and we do it, you know. Wow. And now when I come home, I come running up the driveway and I stop and I take a look and go, ooh, that's a nice, you know, like, that was, you know, that represents a whole Sunday that I invested out with the family doing something, doing some kind of, you know, house maintenance type of stuff. It wasn't easy for me. I probably would have said, well, if you were doing that custom back then, that's what I feel accomplished by this week. You know, that would have been my accomplishment. But, you know, I invested my time. I invested family time into it, and it feels darn good, you know? And I don't have that type of investment in any of these other places. I pass by my bank. You know, I see banks, you know, you got Bank Leumi, and you got Chase, and you got this and that. And now I pass by my bank, Provident Bank. Oh, Provident. You know, that's where the land fortune resides over there. That's where I've been putting the, you know, the checks and the deposits. And the other thing, the second thing the Talmud said, is a person's wife. You know, you can be a sea of humanity. You can be in China with 1.2 billion people, you know, and here's my wife. Oh, dear. You know, that's where my heart resides. That's where I've been investing my love and caring, you know, for the last 25 plus years. You know, that's my place. That's it. And the other thing, and what's the third thing? Third thing is people from one's own hometown, because there's something called Shaychus, community. People from Westchester County, from Eastchester. Someone tells me they're from Eastchester. Wow, you know, what can I do to help you? I don't know why it works that way. Again, you can be in China with 1.1 billion people, and go, oh, you're from Kew Garden Hills too. Oh, hey, where are you going out to dinner tonight? You know? Why, of all those people here, you decide to go out to dinner with them tonight, you know, while you're on vacation? Because they're from your hometown, because they have the same rabbi, the same community, there's some kind of there's threads of connectedness. So whenever we create threads of connectedness, we feel differently about the one that we're giving to. You know, if you buy a stock, if you're working in a certain field in a company, and you contributed to something, so that's your company, that's your organization, that's your house, that's your picture, you hung it on the wall, you know, and it makes you, gives you that feeling of expansion. And therefore, when a person gives to somebody else, they end up feeling good about the other person. It's a little bit like, again, another show tune from Fiddler on the Roof. You know, don't talk of, not the other ones, don't talk of love, show me, but after 25 years, I want you. If that's not love, you know, okay, it's a little bit, maybe it might be a little bit satirical over there, but the premise is that, you know, after giving and giving and giving and giving and giving, you know, there's so many electrons that have been shared, there's so many bonds that have been created, and the person sees themselves shining outside of the other person's face. They see the investment that they give coming back and looking back at them, so that makes us feel different about the one that we've given to. We don't give necessarily to the ones we love the ones to whom we give, right? And therefore, the mandate of giving and the principle of giving creates a whole new different dynamic, even if we're not in the mood of it. One of my rabbis said that sometimes people come to him, they tell him, you know, I just don't feel like they're in a relationship. I just don't feel it. He says, do, give, do it, and give, and contribute, and do, and give. He says, you'll feel different. Yeah, but I don't feel, you know, right, you don't feel like it. You're not in the mood of it. So you like this guy who sits and says, I don't like to go to davening in the morning. You'll like the way you feel when you're done, when you've given and you've contributed and you've invested your heart into this other person. Okay, now comes the C. We didn't get the C yet. That's the big advantages of mice, of doing. And now comes C. What is C squared? So C, in the equation that we're gonna that I'm gonna try to spell out is C stands for decisions. That's right. That's D. Okay, I'm sorry. I tried, you know? Okay, we'll get around to it, though, in a second. So, because one of the unique things that we do as human beings is that a human being has the ability to make decisions. We have the ability to make decisions. Having free will is the miracle of creation, that we have the ability to agree with the Almighty and to align ourselves with his will and his creation, or to disagree and to defy and to rebel. Every other creature, the angelic world, the angels, they see things so clearly that they go running like the speed of light when God tells them to do something. Because because there's no interposition, there's no body, there's no heaviness, there's no lag time, and there's nothing that stops them from fulfilling that will. And the animal world, animals, you know, they do what they, you know, doing what comes naturally. You know, they just, that's their instinct, is to eat or to bite or to chase or to scare mice. Cats chase mice. You know, you can't say to a cat, you know, just say no to mice. You know, that's what it is. You know, that's what he does. You know, they have their, you know, that's their instinct. That's their instinct. But a human being has the ability to say no and to say I want to do something different. We're not talking about free choice. You know, is it going to be milkshakes or fleishigs tonight? Right? Is it going to be pizza or is it going to be Indian food? We're talking about those are more like preferences. Those are horizontal preferences. We're talking about, so free choice means, am I going to go up like Jacob's ladder? Behine sula mutav arta v'rosha megiya shemayim. Am I going to go up or am I going to go down? That's the premise of free choice. Does it bring me closer to my Creator or am I propelling myself further away? So, and actually this idea really settled into my mind. It was something that happened a number of years ago. I was involved with a seminar in California with someone I knew for a long time, and I know him for a long time. And big Israeli, a bulvan, a real strong-headed and strong-hearted fellow who was making seminars all over the country. And I was going to these seminars to demonstrate the veracity and the truth of Torah. And an Israeli fellow, he lived in South Africa for a while. He had been a millionaire. He lost his millions. He's unbelievable, you know, like a life. You could write seven novels. He had so many lives and so many gilgulim, so many different things that he went through. And then he built a beautiful Jewish family, and he's helping so many people. So I went out there to California. It wasn't the first time I was out there with him. And we had an atomic bomb seminar. It was unbelievable. Transformation. People were so excited. It was off the charts. And I don't remember anything from the seminar. All I remember is the conversation I had a day later because my flight was delayed. And after the seminar's over, I like to give myself a little bit of a relaxation. I haven't done it for such a long time. I like to give myself a little bit of a, you know, to go out and buy a partega, maybe a cigar, something like that, to kick up my heels. As chatai ani mazkir hayom, I mentioned my sin today, you know. And to give myself, and I asked him, you know, Chezi, is there a place around here maybe I can get like a good cigar? Maybe I'll get you one. And he says, no, I don't smoke. I said, yeah, you wouldn't even smoke a cigar? He says, no. He says, I used to smoke cigarettes. The first time we're talking just between us, I said, oh, yeah? I said, when was that? I know you for 8 years. I never saw you smoke a cigarette. He says, yeah, but a little more than 8 years ago, I stopped. He says, I was smoking for 30 years. He says, 3 packs a day. I said, 3 packs a day? I don't 3 packs a day. I don't believe you told anything else you told me that you did in your lifetime. That's a full-time job. You know, that's one after the other. All the waking hours of the day. I said, how do you do it? And I said, why'd you stop? I became curious. Why'd you stop? How'd you stop? He says, I just looked one time and I saw it like it disgusted me. And I said, I saw somebody else. And I said, that's it. And I said, that's it. And that's it. And you just stopped? He says, that's it. I stopped. I was like, and you just stopped? That was it? I said, what? You know? I said, that was unbelievable. You know, what? You mean 3 packs a day for 30 years and then, and then you stopped? He said, yeah, that's it. I stopped. Unbelievable. And I was when the plane took off, you know, the later that day, I was thinking, that's unbelievable. I said, the guy just arrested a habit, such a deeply rooted and ingrained habit in his system that he's doing for 30 years. I mean, 3 packs a day. Wow! How did he do it? That's unbelievable. Just so happens I had a sefer with me, a book with me, Nefesh HaChaim, by the great student of the Vilna Gaon, Rav Chaim Volozhin. And he has in the first chapter, he quotes in a footnote a Zohar. And the Zohar, mystical book, says that when a person even thinks about doing a mitzvah, they make a decision in their mind that they're going to do a mitzvah. That decision thing again, right? They make a decision in the mind that they're going to do a mitzvah. So what happens the minute it's Ola B'Machshev, it even enters a person's mind, the person, he says, is immediately surrounded by something called an Or HaMakif, which is like a power pack, a spiritual envelopment that surrounds the person. He says, and that's what gives the person the courage and the initial inertia to make that first step and to make the accomplishment. And he said, I said, that's what happened. The guy decided, I'm not going to smoke cigarettes. And once he made that decision that he's not going to do it, so then all of a sudden he got pushed into the, and now the person has a certain inertia on their own. And once they're already doing it, and they have to fight now all the force of the what to do with the hands and the habits and the friends and try one of mine and what do you do with the hands the next day, he has to face up to this because he made a decision that he's going to do it. And to the extent that the person makes that decision, that he said, that's the extent that the person is visited with that type of power pack. Depends upon what type of decision. or maybe we'll call it C, commitment. Okay, there we go. Okay, D, that rhymes with C, and that stands for commitment. Choice would be nice, but that's a smaller version. C, commitment. Wow. I said, that's unbelievable. When that settled into my brain, I said, wow, look what happened. A person made a commitment. They made a decision with a capital C, a commitment that now allowed them to uproot and to change the river of their actions and their habits. I said, that is an unbelievable accomplishment. Wow, what did he do over there? And it all happened in a flip in the switch that the person had in their mind. And I said, when I saw that, I said, now I understand something. A question that had been bothering me at that time, I think it was something like 17 years, because I was married at that time 17 years. Now I'm married 25 years, and I'm thinking, you know, there is I answered that question already. And that question is, why do people want to go to weddings? How can you got so many people that are going out of their way? There's a wedding taking place. So 500 people have to show up for this wedding. What if 500 people have an interest in coming to a wedding for? Coming out, you know, the people are flying in from Israel. A bus is coming in from Brooklyn. You know, some other relatives are coming down from Canada. You know, they're all buying new suits and getting gowns. Gowns. Oh, yeah, gowns. Okay. And, you know, and which color is their wedding routine wearing? And they, you know, oh my gosh, you know. And there's going to be a 7-piece band. And you're going to have, and these people come, they're going to wear these new suits. They're going to take it out of the plastic from the cleaners. And then after they're done with the event, it's going to be 3 hours. Oh, hold your shove money, Ari. And they're going to ring it out. And then people are going to walk around zombies for the next couple of days, because until they get back to their place, until they wake up the next day, and they're going to be totally disoriented and dislocated for the next couple of days. Why do people want to come? And they're all coming with a gift, with a challah cover or even a check in their hands. You know, why do people want to come? When I got married, my wife, her father is a tailor, is a simple tailor from Poland. He's a tailor, lived in the Bronx his whole life. He saved a few pennies. He has one daughter, an only daughter, and now he spent his whole life savings to make this wedding. I told him, Daddy, give the money to us. You know, she has a small family. We have a small family. And you got to invite 500 strangers, you know, and 500 chickens have to give their life for this event, you know. And I'm going to be like, what's going on? Why do they want to come? What's the big lure? What's the big attraction? What's the magnetism of people want to come to a wedding? And so when I understood this principle, I said, ooh, I got it. So what's the big attraction? And I think that what people find so inviting about a wedding, that they pick themselves up and they move to, is because it's like one of those old-time rocket launches. They don't make such a big deal about it these days. But I remember when I was a kid, you know, Cape Canaveral, remember? You know, 10, 9, 8, you know, and they had those ground photos, and you can see the ground begin to shake, you know, 1. You can see the camera shake. We have liftoff. Because when a person decides that they're going to do something, it's not just one person saying, I'm going to stop smoking, or I'm going to do this thing about, I'm going to change this habit, or I'm going to become this or not become that. Right? It's a person saying, there's two people saying they're going to do something that's going to affect not just, you know, one person doing something about one area of their life, but now two people doing something that's going to affect every area of their whole life. And now what they're saying, now they're being visited with a power package that said, and how long are we going to do this for? This is not just a fad or a fanciful type of moment over here, you know, that we're taking. This is something we're going to do it forever. We're going to stay with this forever. And therefore, the magnitude of the power pack, which is visited upon the bride and the groom at that time, the fuel, the energy pack, which is available at that time, people come to bask in the glory and the afterglow of what's available at the time when that bride and groom are launching their life together. They have to stay together, come what may. The in-laws, the outlaws, right? The calls from the principal, the late nights with the kids, all the different, you know, they say there was one father was explaining to his kids, he said, you see this white hair over here? He has a story about every white hair. You see this white hair over here? He says, this is the time I got the call from the principal. You see? This is the time you broke the neighbor's window. This is the time I had to pick you up at the police station, you know? And he's going through an explanation of every white hair. And the kid says, oh, that's why Zadie has such a white beard, you know? Yeah, but you know, but people make this commitment, and everybody comes and says, wow, that's what's happening. This is what we're coming to bask in the afterglow. We want to be there when these people make that type of commitment, because there's something there. There's something, that spiritual energy, which is palpable and present at that time. And now one step more, everything we know about a wedding, everything that we, all the practices that surround a wedding, many of them, most of them, are a hint and a faint echo and a shadow of something that happened 3,322 years ago, when the Jewish people stood by Mount Sinai, right? We have a chuppah that stands overhead. So at that time, it says the Almighty held a mountain over the head of the Jewish people, and we were all ready to for whatever. What is a whole other story and an explanation, right? All the things there were five voices that were heard. So also five voices, you know, by the bride and the groom. We can draw there's many parallels and many customs that are copying that event that happened when the Jewish people received the Torah 3,322 years ago, and when it was offered to the Jewish nation. What did we say unanimously? Anybody remember that famous call to action? Naseh v'nishma. We're going to do. And then we're going to hear a little bit of sort of a backwards type of a statement, counterintuitive. And Rabbeinu Yonah asks, he says, how can you do before you hear? Very simple question. We're going to do, and then we're going to hear. You know, let's go. Go where? Where are we going? How are you going to do it before you hear? He says, what it means is we're committed to doing before we understand what it's all about. We're committed. And he says, and therefore, when the Jewish people said Naseh v'nishma at that time, so it was a whole nation standing together saying that we're going to remain the Jewish people for the next, you know, the 3,322 for the next 4,000, however long it takes, ad bi'as gol tzedek till the end of times, till v'haya Hashem lemelech al kol ha'aretz b'yomu Hashem echad u'shemo echad, and we're going to stay together till the end of times, and come what may come, pogroms and anti-Semitism and a 2,000-year plus exile and piguim explosions and all kinds of different persecutions, and we're going to remain together, and we're going to hunker down, and we're going to let all those waves of opposition pass over us, all the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, and we're going to remain the Jewish people forever. And that's what was present at that time when the Jewish people launched themselves on this mission. And any time a person wants to tap into that energy, that's what's available for us, and that's what's available whenever a person wants to do a mitzvah. We're tapping into that type of spiritual energy. So with that having been said, we can explain now something called what is C squared. C squared is the constant of life. It's hanging on to a constant. What allows a husband and wife or two people to stay together is that they're committed to each other. And what is the commitment? It's a two-way commitment. This, I think, explains the C squared. There's actually one place, there's two places in Chumash, in the whole Torah, where it says we have a mitzvah to be dovek, to be attached to something, to be endlessly dutiful and loyal. In the first place we find in the Torah, it says, Al ken yazov ishes avi ve'imo v'dovek be'isho. It says by the first couple, Adam and Eve, therefore a man should abandon his husband and his mother and father, excuse me. It doesn't mean abandon them, throw them under the bus. It means, you know, that the apple rolls away from the tree. You've got to form your own primary unit. There's nothing more special, you know, not the loyalty. The loyalty to the parents is not as strong as the bond that should exist between the new, the fealty and the specialness of that new couple over there. That's a new primal unit. Nobody gets in between them. Therefore, the person should be dovek beishto. The husband and wife should be cleaving to each other. And yet it says in another place in Chumash later on, we have a mitzvah that says, uvo sidbach, to cleave to him, to cleave to God, dovka bo. How to fulfill that? That's a whole story itself. So now the question is, how can a person have two 24/7 jobs? How is that possible? How can this, you know, you're cleaving to God, cleaving to the wife. You know, I got to, you know, well, now it seems I have a conflict of interest. If I go here, then I, you know, I'm cutting it short over here. If I'm not here, I'm not there. How can I have two 24/7 jobs? I remember when Lieberman was running for vice president, right? He had one of his statements was, he says, you know, if you elect me to be vice president, he says, I'll serve you 24/6. Yeah. Now, how can I be in two places? How can I be, you know, two full time? It's not possible. It's not possible. So it's really what we call a klutz kasha. It's really a straw dog. And the answer is, he says, that we know that the word ish and isha is one of the most famous things that's said when bride and groom get married, is that either word ish and isha are really almost the same word. They have both have this two of the same letters, common letters, aleph and shin, which is really the word for ish, for fire. But they have two uncommon letters, and that is the yud and the hay, which are really the essence of the Almighty's name. So really, what keeps them from being a consuming fire is that they both have a name of a God together. It's the cleaving that both of them have to God that allows them to cleave together. When people are committed to the constant of the light, so then it doesn't matter wrinkles and gray hair and this and health and all these different things, because the thing that's holding them together, the bond, the glue, the commitment, is not to, you know, to this set of 60 trillion cells that happens to make up the human system, right? Because those cells are changing. Every 7 years, a person's is a totally different person, right? But yet it was the commitment to the soul. It was the soul commitment that the people have to each other. That's what makes the relationship a relationship. And the beauty of it is that when that piece is in place, right? And that's why one of my rabbis once said, never use the D word. I'm not even going to say it, right? Not that there is such a portion of the Torah that allows for the D, you know, which is really a G in Hebrew. Yeah. The D, people throw that around, because you throw it around, that means that there's no commitment. If there's no commitment, then people say, why should there's no FDIC? I don't feel comfortable. I don't feel secure to put my money into this bank. But once there's a commitment there, commitment, and that commitment can be renewed and reinvigorated and reconstituted every second. It's not something that happened once. 25 years ago I got married. Everybody makes a mistake, the jokes that people make. No. It's I got married, today. I got married today. Well, you got married today? Oh, my God, not get married just now. I decided again. You decide again and again. You make the commitment again and again, and you compound that energy that's available. And the person gets any reinvested back into Meisim, because we know that this one is committed and that one's committed. Both sides are committed. When both sides are committed, then we don't mind investing and putting more and more and doing more and more deeds and reinvesting. Because it's not about what's right anymore, who's right. It's about now what's right to do the right thing. And therefore, it's like the FDIC, Once we know that it's federally backed, that there's a backing, we hope, to the investments that are being put in, then people don't mind. When there's trust, then there's a certain fluidity, and the relationship people will invest and invest. I just thought it was an interesting thing that many of the words for banking have been usurped. One of the words that banking world industry has used were usurped from the language of spiritual, the best of spiritual relationships. It's really interesting. I have a short list over here. Security. After all, what are people looking for in a relationship? Is he a working boy? Does he work? Does he have a job? What do we look for? Look for security. You have to be worried about, will you still love me tomorrow? Okay. That shouldn't be a question. It's a commitment. Once there's a commitment, so then, of course you're going to love you tomorrow. And if you're not in the mood of it, you're still going to do it. You're still going to act like it. You're still going to continue to invest like it, and it will grow. It will get there. Bond. How about that? Interest. Mutual. Future. Trust, fidelity, right? My bank, provident, right? Beshert, it's meant to be, So that, there's many others. Mutuals, I mentioned, there's many others. So maybe just finish up with one last story over here. This is, you probably won't remember anything from the evening except for this last story that I'm going to tell you right now. And it's probably the best piece of advice that I ever got, almost from anybody. And I've shared it with lots of people, and I think that it's gone like wildfire all over the place. And people come back to me years later and say, Rabbi, that was unbelievable. You have no idea. Every day, this impacts my day. Wow, okay, good. So I'm going to share with you, and it's native to the discussion that we're having. And I didn't plan to get a piece of advice. I wasn't looking for advice. It came my way, And what happened was, it was one weekday night in our beautiful home in Rockland County in Spring Valley. And it was just one of those nights where, we had kids the kids are still of varying ages, but we had all kinds, from diapers, up to, junior high school, and we had, everything was various stages of homework incomplete and dinner incomplete and getting bath incomplete and going to bed in the pajamas incomplete, everything. It was what we call in Hebrew a balagan, It was like, it's all happening at the zoo. I do believe it's true, it was all happening, And, this one, running, okay, and then that night, unusually so, I had a ride coming that was going to take me to a lecture I'm giving in Queens, in Kew Garden Hills, and I'm going with it. An Israeli friend is coming to pick me up, and the reason why he's picking me up, I can drive myself, is that there's another Israeli lecturer who's giving it a second location nearby. He's giving a lecture. Rabbi Simcha Cohen, who lectures, wrote books, he wrote a book that was translated to English called What Did You Say? I think that's what it's called. Or What Did I Say? Or What Did Somebody Say? Okay. And it's about marriage. He writes about shalom bias, about peace in the home, and these type of things. That's his main subject. So in the middle of all this, what's going on in the house, suddenly here, bump, 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 bump. I said, oh, dear, I got to go. So sorry, And I pick myself up, and I go outside and decompress for a second. Okay, let me put up my game face, and then get down to the car, There's Rabbi Simcha Cohen with his long, white, beautiful beard, walks the talk, such an elegant, beautiful face, I said, now, Rabbi Simcha Cohen doesn't speak a word of English. And my Hebrew is like I learned from learning Mishnah and learning Chumash. That's where I learned Hebrew. So I'm speaking like Shakespearean Hebrew. You know, like we're for out the Shiru team. You know, that's why the cab drivers answer me in English when they understand. Like immediately, okay, we got one of these guys here. You know, hey buddy. You know, yeah. So. But when they get, so I said to Rabbi Cohen, I said, you know, Apo, you know, Manishma, Rabbi Cohen, you know. So he says, oh, Rabbi Leiba, he says, you know, Manishma, he says, Kabbalah da Bracha, he says, you know, did you get the Bracha? He says to me, the Bracha, the blessing. I said, Rabbi Cohen, Achalta v'Sabata, you know, I ate, you know, a while ago, Ubarachta, Barach means the flea, you know, yeah, it means the Ben's blessed. So I said, I ate a long time ago, so I already, you know, did that, ate dinner, been there, done that. And he said, no, he said, Baracha, the Bracha, you know. I said, which Bracha, Rabbi Cohen? He says, you mean those Asher Yatzar posters, you know, that are ubiquitous all over the place? They hand them out in my office, and we have them in, you know, every language and every size. Yeah, I might even have one over here. You know, all these little posters over here. You see them with the pictures around. So he said, yeah. I said, you know, they have them in Persian and French and, you know, Chinese and everything, every language over there. Don't worry about it. We're covered. The Russian, you know, so we have plenty over there. He said, no. He said, Bracha Mishtecha, the bracha from your wife. I said, the bracha, the blessing from my wife. I said, what do you mean the bracha for my wife? What, you know? He says, actually based upon a verse in Parshas Lech Lecha, it says Abraham was blessed because of Sarah when they went down to Egypt and actually became wealthy. So he says, the Medr says that, you know, that they says ena bracha, which really means, you know, even monetary well-being and all. He says, ena bracha shuyit batoch beisel shel adam ela b'schus ishto. He says, the blessing comes to the house because of the merit of the wife. He says, you need your wife's bracha. He starts explaining to me in his sharp Hebrew. He says, how can you expect to give a lecture? How can you do business? How can you do anything? He says, without a bracha from your wife. I said, Rabbi Cohen, we're late. He says, we'll wait, you know. Okay. And I go back up, you know, up the hill. I pass by that spot on the steps. That's yeah. I go into the house, you know. I knock before I even enter my own house. The Talmud says, I enter in, and all of a sudden, all the kids, some gather around. My wife with a baby in the towel says, you know, Abba's here, Abba's here. My wife comes and says, you know, what is it? You know, you came back, you've been gone for 10 minutes. What happened? I said, oh, I forgot something. She goes, what'd you forget? You're just standing there, you know? I said, you were late before. You ran out in such a hurry. I said, yeah. I forgot something. I forgot the bracha. She goes, we ate about 3 hours ago, you know? I don't think you can bench anymore. I don't think you're allowed to say any after blessing anymore for dinner 3 hours ago. You know? She goes, no. I think you might say, the bracha. Get it, you know? And she says, you mean the Asher Yatzar poster? She says, we have copies in every language downstairs. You know, whatever one do you take? They're all lined up. Take whichever. French, Spanish, Portuguese, Chinese, you name it. Take it. Korean, we have that one too. Go ahead, you know. No. He says, bracha me ishti, the bracha from my wife, you know. I said, how can I be successful, you know, in a bracha, shri, but of beis ha-shaladah, no b'schus ishti, only comes in the merit of the world, you know. Now, I'm not a stutterer, you know, but I was, you know, doing pretty good. I mean, you know, and my wife looks at me, she goes, did you lose your job? You know? I told her, I'm self-employed. She goes, what, you been drinking? I said, you left 10 minutes ago and you come back here and you want a blessing from me. What's going on with you? What's happening with you? You know? And I said, Ima, please, Ima. I said, how can I be successful in business and giving a lecture and everything if I don't have a blessing from you, Ima? She goes, who am I, the Lubavitcher Rebbe? I said, no. I said, Mima, please, don't torture me. I just want the bracha. So she says, she goes, okay. She goes, you should have a quick way to get there. Kritza Sederach, quick way to get there. You should have, now that you're leaving late, you should have a Kritza Sederach coming back. You should come back, you should be able to find the Marav in the evening prayer service. And she goes, and while you're there, she says, the word should come out of your heart and enter into people's hearts. It should make a difference in their lives and a difference in the whole world. I said, oh, man. I said, wow. I said, Ima, the kids should get magically to bed, and the house should get somehow cleaned up, and you should be able to read your favorite book and talk to your best friend on the phone. Oh, man. You know, good luck without you around. You know, I said, okay, thanks, mommy. You know, and I go running at the door, and I got wind in my sails. You know, and it was a good lecture that night. And I realized, wow, you know, I had a bracha from my wife. And that set off a whole contagion. I don't go anywhere. On the way here, I get a call from my wife. She left the house before me. She was supposed to come back. I didn't get the bracha. She goes, wait, I just want to give you the bracha. Oh, the bracha. You know, and don't go anywhere. You can't go anywhere without that bracha. You know, and the beauty of it is that you can be together even when you're not together. This one is working on that project over here. This one can be in another part of the world, but now how was my bracha? How, we're wishing well and encouraging each other. That's that spiritual connection. But I just want to say to conclude that there's a caveat. There's a it's a double-edged sword because it comes with a second side. This getting the bracha, and that is, I remember one time I came home and I was home for about 7 minutes. And in those 7 minutes, I think I had 8 kids crying. You know, that was like, you know, oh, don't you, I told you not to draw with a crayon on the wall. Oh, now those are not your crayons anymore. You know, I told you never hit. You never hit. So you're hitting. Now you go, and you hit. That's why you hit. And in 7 minutes, at a world record, I had 8 crying. You know? Wow. Yeah. And just at that moment, bomb, 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 I get a honk and a horn outside. I have to go. I said, Ima, I have to go. I said, Ima, give me the bracha. And my wife says, what are you lecturing on tonight? I said, Chinuch Yeladim. Educating children. She says, my bracha is, they should see right through you. I said, that's it? Yeah. For tonight, that's it. Yeah. So, in order to get the bracha, we have to, not unfortunately, but fortunately, we have to make ourselves worthy of the bracha. So, everybody needs encouragement. People encouraging each other, that makes a difference. E equals MC squared. And when we give that type of action into Meisim, and we do it with a commitment, so then we find more energy to put into more action and to get more commitment and to recommit ourselves, to get more energy to recommit and to watch the relationship grow and grow that way. Thank you very much for the time together. Appreciate it.
I think that Rabbi Lamb's warmth could melt the largest snowdrift around. Does anybody here have any question about why Rabbi Lamb is a life coach? He's a life coach. I mentioned that in the introduction, that he does this professionally. Not only can he coach a football team, and not only can he coach a baseball team based on his experience in his youth, but it's to be able to be a coach to people in terms of how to live. You know, that's the real game. And this man's wisdom and his warmth and his love for people, that's the combination that really helps a person to make it not only to first base in life, but to get it to all the way around to the home plate. We're all very grateful to you, Rabbi Lamb, and we want to give you a bracha that you should continue to inspire audiences worldwide with your unbelievable Torah insight. We're very grateful to you. We want to thank Melanie and Isaac. I would like to mention 2 dates you might want to put aside on your calendar. We've already scheduled our next Jep Identity Lecture. We've invited Dr. Leon Zakharowicz, who is an internationally renowned neurologist. He'll be speaking, God willing, on February 2nd on the subject of brain nutrition. Very interesting fellow. And we have an annual musical program that we've scheduled for Saturday night, February 26th. You can include that on your calendar as well. You're all welcome to go onto our website to see what's happening at JEP, jepofwestchester.com. We do have 2 classes that meet on a weekly basis. The details are on the website, and everybody is welcome to join Melanie and Isaac in the dining room for the delicious refreshments that they've provided, and you should all have a very safe trip home.
If anybody is interested... By the way, my wife in the back, who's only up to literature, if anybody wants to know about an interesting camp, for, you know, if you have a kid or a grandchild, you want to know about an excellent camp. The Jeff camp. There is a Jeff camp. Jeff of Long Island has a wonderful camp. My information is available.
Yeah, because first, your lectures about investing in the relationship.